Podcast Network, supported by the most renowned success stories in business today. Subscribe today and never miss another show on EPN.
Often ignore this side of our business because it's not that we just feel intimidated. We often feel scared when talking about lawyer issues and legal issues. For most of us, it's really outside of our comfort zone. We don't know what we don't know. The idea of hiring a lawyer can be really scary in and of itself, and it also threatens to be pretty expensive. And for many startups or small businesses, it seems really like an expense that can't be justified. Obviously, I think that is a misplaced perspective. This is Jessica Eves Matthews. Join me for Foundations of Business Brilliance right here on EPN.
Welcome to MLM Power Hour with your host, Todd Falcone. Get ready, hold on, and strap yourself in for another hour of raw and totally uncensored training. What is MLM Power Hour? It's your source for no-holds-barred talent-like-it-is training from Network Marketing's number one prospecting coach.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition.
And now, live from his posh studios in Seattle, Washington, your host, Todd Falcone.
You know, I was so blessed in that day that I was, ever more committed to them, the company, and the effort that I needed to do to help me let my family survive. It was, to say the least, a difficult time. The government literally stripped me of virtually every single thing that I owned and all the money that I'd had. I think the hardest thing that I ever had to do was to sit down with my wife and my little boy, Lucas, and to share the likelihood of our family being torn apart. We sat down, I remember, in a little circle, Indian style, on the floor, my legs crossed, and I began to tell my son the error of my ways, and I explained to him exactly what I had done, that I knew I had made a bad decision to break the law, and that I was going to face a judge, and I was going to confess my guilt, and I was going to pay a price for being put in a cage for a very long time, and that in all likelihood he would be a young man when I was free to enjoy our time together again, and that in effect my son, my very own son, would grow up without a father. And I remember, with his own courage and with tears streaming down his face and mine and my wife's too, of course, he drew himself to me nose to nose. And he said, "We're crying, Dad, not because we're afraid, right? But because we're going to miss each other." And I said, "Yeah, that's right." And at the end, I took him to bed to say his prayers. And I got up the next morning. I caught an early plane to face a man who had a reputation as a hanging judge. And my courage in court was really bolstered by friends that had come out. A lot of them had kind of given testimony of my character arising out of, I guess you'd call it, right living of the previous 7 years. Curiously, one of the things I guess I carried was some guilt, and I had given away a lot of my money to all kinds of organizations. I couldn't get rid of the dirty money fast enough. And people came out to talk about how I had pulled some thorns out of their paws, I guess. And I remember feeling certainly humbled, again ashamed, and feeling kind of like I was being eulogized at my own funeral, and undeservedly so. And I remember, too, the judge was sort of strumming, if you will, through a stack of reference letters written from all over the world from these various organizations, kind of being impatient, I guess, waiting to bopped me over the head with the gavel. And all of my speakers were eloquent. Some of them were very powerful, well-known people. But the judge had his eyeballs on my wife. And she apparently was the one person he really did want to hear from. He was almost annoyed by others. And he asked her if she had something to say. She simply told him with a conviction of absolute truth in her voice that the man that she was married to was not the same man of criminal intent of a decade earlier. And he said, she told him how rich her life had become because she was living a life in truth. She said other things that I guess probably would just embarrass me now, but, you know, it seemed like an interminable silence when you could hear a pin drop and you could hear people crying. And the judge stood frozen, and then he looked me in the eye and he said, Mr. McEachern, do you have any idea how lucky you are? And I responded something to the effect of, well, I'm starting to get a sense of it. And he looked down at a piece of paper on which I suppose he had earlier penciled in the time in prison he was sure to give me prior to hearing the voice of my friends and particularly my wife. And hesitatingly, he kind of put an eraser to the paper, and he penciled in another number, and he announced that I would serve 30 months in prison. And everybody was startled that I was given such a light sentence. My lawyer said he'd never seen anything like that in that judge's courtroom. So for me, it was kind of like the first miracle. But there were other miracles to come, and I guess they started when I went to prison. It's hard to find lightness in a place so dark, but I did. And it's helped to renew my faith in a lot of things. I certainly found that prison life was everything it's advertised to be. And it's scary. It gave me certainly time to pray, to reflect, to read, and to talk to God on all kinds of subjects. I certainly wanted help through this. I was scared, I'll admit it. One of the other things I think that I learned is that you have to have the best attitude that you can under any given circumstances. You know, Viktor Frankl says in Man's Search for Meaning, that is our last freedom, is to choose your attitude under any given circumstance. And I remember saying that I was going to make the best use of my time. It was my time, and I wasn't going to let anybody steal it from me. I think you certainly, Todd, have trained well on the subject that it's our one unrenewable resource. I recognized that I had to take advantage of it even under those circumstances. So I started also to observe human nature a lot better, and I realized that one of the things that you need to do is to speak to people's values. And the prison warden was a guy who was under the idea that a well-run prison and subsequently a well-esteemed warden was one who ran a prison whose floors shined. And I was living in a place that was affectionately known as the zoo. And I had I'd walked around one day and I found this big Italian guy smoking a cigar, and I think he was probably drinking cappuccino or something, wondering how in the world did that happen, and asked him if, how was he sort of living life in this place with such dignity. And he said, where are you? And I told him where I was. He said, oh, you're in the zoo. And I said, yeah. I said, where are you? And he showed me. He took me to a place that I didn't even know existed. And by comparison, it looked like a country club. And I was, you could just see me chomping at the bit. I wanted to get where he was. He let me know that it could be done. He said, this warden loves a polished floor. We get points for it. I'm too old to bend over and polish my floor the way it needs to be you've done and the more points you get, the more you can get things from home. He says, it doesn't mean much to you right now. He said, but if you could wear your own underpants, he said, trust me, you're going to feel a lot better. And you could even work your way up to a pair of sneakers. And I looked him square in the eye, and he asked me if I could polish floors. And I said, well, I just can't even imagine what good fortune you're having today because you happen to be looking at the best floor polisher in all of Connecticut. And I got moved in. And one day I was also walking out in the we had really had one freedom, and that freedom really was to walk around a track. And one night I was out walking around a track, and there was a single light on a high post that, you know, gave the guards a vantage point. And as I would walk around, I was kind of taking comfort as that light was casting my own long shadow up on a hill that was kind of like a natural amphitheater. And I can remember literally praying for a sign that I was going to find some peace in this place. And there were two shadows cast up on the hill instantly. And I literally fell to my knees crying and couldn't figure it out. I remember saying, you know, really all I asked for was a sign, and I got it. And I ultimately did figure it out. There was another light bulb on the post that had an intermittent short on it where it would come on occasion, and it would cat like juxtapose two shadows on the hill. I took obviously great comfort in that, and I ended up so excited that, you know, I couldn't wait to call my wife in the morning and told her that she should make out a list of everything she ever wanted. And I can remember her telling me, let me get this straight. You're in prison now, you know, for a month, and you've already gone crazy. And I'm sure that that's exactly what I sounded like to her, because I had, you know, instantly switched gears and decided that there was going to be a new day. Well, recognizing that warden's desire for beautiful floor, I ended up literally polishing all the floors for all the old Italians in that place, getting a reputation. Everybody wanted me to polish their floors, and I ultimately convinced the warden that I should be given a shot to clean up the one eyesore in the whole prison, which was the telephone room. Well, you can imagine how it went. You know, if you polish your floor, clean it properly enough, put on enough layers of wax, and bring it up to a high enough sheen, it takes very little maintenance to keep it up. But I had, I guess, cajoled the warden into roping it off every day so that I could have free access, so that I could bring it up to the kind of standards that he would like. So, in effect, that phone room became my phone room. And it was from there that I really launched what would become my most successful chapters in multi-level marketing. And I literally had to polish the floor on my hands and knees. I had to polish the shoes of some well-connected Italians. And I would make telephone calls. And I would make them through my wife. And whenever there was the threat or the accusation that I was making business phone calls, I was told that if I'd made another business phone call, I would be thrown in the hole. I would literally have all my freedoms taken away, including daylight and visitation of my wife and son. And I made them anyway, because I'd left my wife and son in a position where I had no choice but to succeed. And there was a couple of occasions I did get thrown in the hole. And I would come out and I would start to make more phone calls again anyway. And I would literally call my wife, and she would send literature to people, and I was in a position where if they expressed enough of an interest, I then had to confess them to her where I was and that I wouldn't be there to help them. Although I did, in some cases, I can remember sending, I literally was directing corporate talent to do meetings in places where I had gotten leads from guys from inside and people on the outside, and they would go to the meetings. And I remember one instance where I told a woman that I had five people that I expected to go to a meeting, and she should go there, and she could have all the enrollments. I got back to her through my wife the next couple of days, and I remember her saying, you know, only four of your people showed up. I said, well, that's a pretty doggone good record. And I only signed up three of them. She was expressing her own disappointment. I said, well, let me ask you a question. I said, how many people did you bring to the meeting? And she went into a litany of excuses, which is certainly something everybody on this phone call has heard of. You know, I guess the dog ate the newspaper and she had a headache and her kid had to go to cheerleading or something. But she brought nobody, and she was grousing about the fact that I only put three people under her. And I said, things sound pretty rough out there. I said, you know, I'm in here, and Bubba and I are dancing and fighting over my underpants, and I'm still in them. And I'm being threatened, being thrown in the hole, and you're telling me about cheerleading in newspapers. I said, I'm having a little bit hard time relating.
Yeah.
But anyway, this good company and its corporate people continue to do meetings around the country, and I continue to do telephone calls. And it took root. It took hold. And I probably talked to or sent out messages one way or another to a couple of thousand people in the time that I was there.
That many people?
To that many people.
With the threat daily of getting tossed in the hole.
It was nearly daily. And it could be hours at a time on some days. And certainly, you know, we got a great mixed response. Again, I'm always sort of intrigued with the amount of people who tell me how heavy the telephone is and how hard it is to get on the phone and make a telephone pitch. But I felt like I didn't have a choice. I had a lot of making up to do to a lot of people. And, you know, I had an obligation, and I was committed to not letting anybody steal my time.
Again, this is Todd Falcone here on EPN, and you can find me at www.toddfalcone.com. That's T-O-D-D-F as in Frank, A-L-C-O-N-E.com. And thanks so much for tuning in to the MLM Power Hour show here on EPN. This is Todd Falcone. Have a great week.
The ePodcast Network, supported by the most renowned success stories in business today. Subscribe today and never miss another show on EPN.
This is Liz Lynch. Join me for Business Development Radio right here on EPN.